Morning, friends. It is past midweek, and it's time I came clean. This reading of Quakerism as an attempt at fulfilling Christianity, or again as a radicalizing spirit, is a motivated reading. One designed to serve a particular purpose. I don't feel badly about that, as I think that all readings are motivated readings. But I do want to be honest about my motivation. My motivation is to promote respectful and open dialogue and mutual learning, especially at a spiritual level, between what have long been and sadly too often still remain largely antagonistic branches of Quakers. There is much at stake for very many of us in such conversations, and some of what I want to say is hard to say and hard to hear. I say it humbly and with some fear and trembling. It is profoundly important for me, therefore, to say what I have to say today in the right spirit, a spirit of generosity and love. And I pray friends hear it in the spirit in which it is offered, not as an accusation, but as an invitation to friends to engage in the always difficult, but also glorious, task of examining our own prejudices. Part of this motivation of seeking healthier relationships between diverse groupings of friends is autobiographical, and so what I have to say is very much colored by my own experience. I am a lifelong friend with deep ties and commitments to Quakerism and its potential for contributing to what early friends would not have hesitated to call the kingdom of God, a potential marred, on my view at least, by the way in which we live our divisions. I personally have lived these divisions and live in them still. I was raised an evangelical friend in a small Quaker meeting in southern Ontario that was one of the few that refused membership in Canadian Yearly Meeting when, in 1955, the then Hicksite, Orthodox, and Wilburite meetings reunited into our current Canadian Yearly Meeting. My father was a young man at the time, and while largely led by others of riper age and experience, was among the team who, fearing for the Christian character of the local meeting, declined to join Canadian Yearly Meeting. When I first encountered Canadian Yearly Meeting folks some quarter of a century ago, there were some old-timers who still remembered my father as difficult, as the opposition. So I was raised a friend, but one with suspicions about liberal friends. And my attendance at an evangelical friend's university did little to attenuate those suspicions. But, young and adventurous, of course I didn't listen. While I didn't get much involved for a while, as a graduate student I began attending unprogrammed meetings. You know you're a nerd when your idea of living dangerously is hanging around with the wrong kind of Quakers. Be that as it may, I liked what I found there, here. What I found there was the same depth and sincerity of spiritual struggle, the same profound desire to know and do the will of God, the same sense of community and love that I had grown up with among evangelical friends, even if much of what was transpiring was inspired by different priorities, transacted under different names, spoken in a different dialect. There were and are important differences between the branches of friends. Serious differences. And these should not, indeed cannot, be ignored or underplayed. Friends between the branches, and as often within the branches too, genuinely disagree with one another on matters that matter. But despite those differences, there is no doubt in my mind and heart that both in the community of my youth and in the community I have grown into as an adult, the Spirit is at work, and I am among friends. I have come to know and love liberal friends as I have long known and loved more theologically conservative friends, and I am able to enter into meaningful worship in both contexts. I am a Christian Quaker, so I commune with joy among evangelical and Orthodox friends, but I have a progressive social agenda, so I'm able to join enthusiastically with liberal friends in promoting that. For me, though I know I speak here out of my own experience, an experience I know is not shared by everybody, both are family. Because of this, I confess to being troubled and quite hurt when I hear friends on each side of this divide maligning the other side, however subtly, even unknowingly. I am troubled and quite hurt when I hear liberal friends, sometimes even as a part of ministry in meeting, being dismissive of, even hostile to, Christianity and more Orthodox friends. And I am equally troubled and hurt when I hear evangelical and Orthodox friends, sometimes even from the pulpit, taking swipes at liberals and liberal friends. I know that people are vulnerable and often in pain themselves, so I mostly try to suck it up and not let it bother me too much. But often it does, especially when it has a sharp edge to it, especially when, in a flexing of our egos, we take these differentiations as an opportunity to define ourselves over against the others. Like the Pharisee in the Gospel who prays, "God, thank you, I am not like one of those other people." Especially when what is being said is not entirely true, or true in a way that is not really fair, that reduces a flesh and blood person to a few quick, unflattering indicators. In moments of frustration, I too still succumb to such temptation. And in my case, with friends on both sides, so I am a worse offender than anyone, and I am working on repenting of it. One of the interesting and seductive things about caricatures is that they are based on real features, but these are exaggerated, and the rough outlines they present do not give us the subject's true character. That's why they are good for the purposes of humor, but inappropriate for genuine understanding. And that is also how caricatures are distinguished from portraits that are supposed to capture character and are therefore not often funny. If a portrait makes you laugh, it's a bad portrait. If a caricature doesn't make you laugh, it's a bad caricature. Initiatives like Baltimore Yearly Meeting's intervisitation program among friends of different kinds is precisely an attempt to move us, with respect to each other, past the level of caricature and onto portraiture, if not genuine friendship. If nothing else, I find it something of a mockery of our peace testimony that we want to encourage Jews and Palestinians, Tutsis and Hutus, Americans and Iranians to work cooperatively across their differences. But we friends not only cannot often find a way to work together on worthwhile common projects, we often cannot even find a way to talk meaningfully with each other. Though, of course, sometimes we do. We tend, seemingly by nature, to gravitate to those who already agree with us, which makes life a lot easier and allows us to get on with things. As a philosopher, I am inclined to move backwards, to question starting points rather than assume them. As the French Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas notes, the beginning of ethics is to be put into question. Only in the face of genuine difference are our self-certainties and self-aggrandizements and our thoughtless impositions of our own understandings upon others shattered. We should be grateful for the one who challenges us. My conviction, right or wrong, is that we are richer in knowing one another, in learning from one another, especially from those with whom we disagree. As Levinas puts it elsewhere, only the other can teach me. Chances are that the person with whom I disagree is not deluded, but that they see something that I don't see, and that they therefore have something I need. That is, they have something to share with me that will deepen and broaden my own understanding and experience. We Quakers often struggle with the fact that on so many issues of profound importance, we find ourselves out of unity with one another, and particularly with those of what we call the other branches. It is therefore worth thinking a bit about unity. For we do indeed have a sense of unity that comes from the language of business meeting when we say that we have come to unity when we all, or all of us who do not stand aside, consent that a particular decision is in the will of God. In that sense, unity does mean something like agreement, albeit in traditional Quaker thinking, this does not mean that we agree with each other, but that we agree with God, the true Quaker autocrat. But that is not the only, and perhaps not even the most important, sense of the term. While not always easy to achieve, the unity of agreement is in some ways the cheapest form of unity. It is easy to be in unity with those with whom we agree. A deeper and more difficult form of unity is hanging in there with others precisely when we don't agree, and when the prospects of agreement are slim to none, when we are committed to one another despite disagreements, as anyone who has been in a long-term relationship knows. In this sense, disagreement is not the end of unity, but its crucible, its most stringent test. For most of us, on most matters, including for most of Quaker history, at least since the second third of the 19th century, the failure to reach unity of the first kind, the unity of agreement, has precipitated the loss of the second kind of unity, the unity of mutual commitment as well. We have given up on unity and gone our separate ways, each leaving the other to their own devices and excesses. There is something good about that. Each side is able to get on with things in a way that they couldn't before, and I don't want to downplay that genuine advantage. But I am suggesting that something is lost thereby as well. A broader sense of fraternity and sorority, but also a richness of opinion, and perhaps most importantly, the necessity of patient imaginativeness in waiting worship with those with whom we disagree, seeking God's guidance for a way forth that cuts across the entrenched positions on both sides. We are, in my judgment, too quick as Quakers of diverse branches to take sides in what since at least the 1980s has been known as the culture wars. Liberal friends agreeing almost point for point with a left-wing political agenda and accepting whatever implications they take that as having for religious life. And evangelical and orthodox friends agreeing almost point for point with a right-wing theological agenda and accepting whatever implications they take that as having for political life. At that point, I'm not sure what function being a Quaker has to play in things, except as a backup for what we already want. Perhaps I am deluded. Well, I almost am certainly deluded. But somehow, I expect more from us. The spirit to which we attend should be neither the spirit of the left nor the spirit of the right, but the spirit of God. Seeking the guidance of that spirit, especially with those with whom we disagree, is much harder than circling the wagons with those with whom we already agree, and requires a unity of mutual commitment prior to a unity of agreement. But that might be the only hope for a broader unity of agreement that undermines and transforms the current ideological divide that is tearing the larger social fabric and the Quaker fabric with it apart. What if, rather than taking sides in the current ideological divide and demonizing those on the other side, we were to sit worshipfully with those on the other side and demonize the ideological divide? What a testimony that would be to the world. Part of my agenda this week is to plead for that testimony. My specific agenda to this end is to sketch out an understanding of Quakerism that will allow Quakers on both sides, on all sides, to understand themselves and those Quakers with whom they disagree as exploiting legitimate and necessary trajectories within the space opened up by early Quakerism, and this so that we might see ourselves as belonging to and relying upon each other, even across our very real and important disagreements. Rather than being settled in our concerns and reading these back into Quakerism as its essential core, and correlatively reading the concerns of other friends out of the core as superfluous accidents or later impositions, I am attempting to read early Quakerism as the spiritual and conceptual space that opened up the possibility of the diverse interpretations Quakerism has undergone. That is, what early Quakers held in a living dialectical tension has degenerated for contemporary friends into two opposing camps. It was because early Quakers were uncompromisingly convinced of the power of the inward Christ to remake them that no static articulations of that power, which they referred to as outer, were considered adequate to it, which is why they were committed to the doctrine of continuing revelation. It was because early Quakers were radical in the sense of grounded in the essential that they were radical in the sense of innovative and progressive. It was because early Quakers were rooted in Christianity that they were open to new light. These two sides, held in dialectical tension by early friends, a tension that was the very life or spirit of the fellowship, have become bifurcated for contemporary friends. Orthodox friends laying claim to the sense of radical that suggests rooted in foundations, and liberal friends embracing the sense of radical as pressing toward revolutionary change. While early friends sought the fulfillment of Christianity, Orthodox friends seek to preserve rather than fulfill it, and liberal friends tend toward leaving it behind. Thus, Orthodox friends exploit and highlight the thoroughgoing commitment to Christ that animated early and until quite recently almost all of Quakerism, but are perhaps too quick to identify in an unquestioning way the Christ of Quaker experience with the theologically constructed Christ of historical Christianity. Orthodox friends, often quoting second-generation Quakers, anxious to ensure a persecuting culture that Quakers were indeed Christian, tend to overlook the fact that for early friends, the preceding 1600 years of Christian orthodoxy, since after the apostles' days, were considered to be lost in apostasy. The concern with creeds, the wedding of ecclesiastical and state power, the authority and enforcement of theological precepts, all of this was, in their phrase, out of the power. Orthodox friends tend to overlook just how unorthodox early Quakers were. But this is not because friends desired to be unorthodox, not because they took any perverse pride in being recalcitrant, but because they wanted to be truly orthodox. That is, they sought to ground their testimonies and teachings in the truth, that is, in the life and power of God. But to do this, they had to take definitive difference from the orthodoxy of the day, even as they called the so-called orthodox of the day to a deeper and genuine orthodoxy, obedience not to the Christ of human theological construct, but the Christ within. Orthodoxy is, then, or at least I am suggesting, a genuine but partial expression of the Quaker way. In an equal but opposite gesture, liberal Quakers, as the name suggests, revel in their liberation from traditional religious forms, which is entirely consistent with the founding inspiration of Quakerism. For many of us who have grown up in highly restrictive, even oppressive or abusive religious communities, this freedom is like a fresh breath of mountain air after the suffocating closeness of authoritarianism. But what tends to be eclipsed in the exhilaration of this emancipation is that the Quaker freedom from authority was, at least for early friends, anything but the humanistic freedom from that leaves us obedient only to ourselves and our own best judgments, but a freedom necessary to a deeper and unequivocal obedience to the inward Christ. Quaker freedom from worldly authorities was not freedom from authority. It was a freedom from worldly authorities for the sake of obedience to the true authority. So Quaker business practices were never a question of seeking consensus, but of seeking God's will. The sense of the meeting, the outcome of worshipful waiting upon the Spirit of God, was the sign of, and in no way a substitute for, God's leading. And this leading, moreover, was never an expression of what I or we were comfortable with or wanted. One of the clearest signs for early friends that a leading was from God was that, in their phrase, it was across to me, that it was precisely what I did not want, and that I was bound to obey it regardless, as the only way to be released, made free from it. Liberality is another genuine but partial expression of the Quaker way. My proposal in arguing for Quakerism as the fulfillment of Christianity, which early Quakers would have seen simply as true Christianity, in arguing for Quakerism as a radicalizing spirit, is to provide a framework in which friends of each of our orientations can see themselves, but see themselves as functioning within a movement that is larger than any particular orientation itself. I want to refer to these different orientations as trajectories, suggesting that they are going somewhere and from somewhere, more like energies within a larger field of force than static positions. If the more liberal side of Quakerism traces out a vector that leads out from the source into an ever new beyond, a centrifugal force straining toward new light, a universalizing force that sketches out the way of innovation, the more orthodox side of Quakerism traces out a vector that seeks to renew itself ever again from the roots, a centripetal force that brings us back to draw living water from reliable sources. For early friends, these were not two divergent paths, but integrated and complementary trajectories, aspects of the same living spirit, integrated moments within the very life of the spirit. And if we want to renew the famous Quaker tree metaphor, though perhaps here turning it on its side, we might say that liberal friends revel in the fruits of the Quaker tradition, while the Orthodox friends attend to to the roots. That, of course, is a vast generalization, as liberals, too, are interested in roots, and the Orthodox have picked some fine fruits. But as an image, it perhaps works at a certain level. But as I well know, having grown up on Cherry Street, a fruitful tree requires both of these aspects, perpetual renewal and new growth, and where these two aspects are part of one and the same process. If we don't attend to the roots, the season for Quaker fruits will be few, which is what I think, metaphorically speaking, may be happening in many of our liberal meetings. And if we are too exclusively oriented to the roots, we become fearful of allowing new fruits to come to maturity, pruning vital, fresh branches with reckless caution, which is what I think is happening in many of our Orthodox meetings. My proposal that we think Quakerism as a fulfillment of Christianity might then be restated as follows. Just as Jesus' relationship to the law is an expression of the law that puts the law at risk, so Quakerism is an expression of Christianity, but one in which Christianity itself is put at risk. In light of this formula, liberal Quakers will no doubt accuse me of trying to keep Christ at the center of Quakerism, even as Orthodox friends will no doubt accuse me of selling out Christ. Indeed, I am trying to maintain the uncomfortable position where both accusations might be true. Thinking Quakerism as an expression of Christianity in which Christianity is at risk is a tricky proposition, because it opens up the very real possibility that Quakerism might exceed Christianity itself. One is then faced with the peculiar prospect that the most faithful expression of Christianity is no longer necessarily Christian, at least not in any recognizable sense. Just as fulfilling the law puts the law at risk, but for the sake of the law, so a genuinely fulfilled Christianity puts Christianity itself at risk, but for the sake of the way of Christ. For those of us with an attachment to Christianity, that is a frightful prospect, even as it liberates us for fresh winds of the Spirit and opens us to new light. But that is, I am suggesting, not only a Quaker reading of Christianity, albeit one that I think Quakers have undertaken particularly well, but is at the heart of Christianity itself. As Christ himself puts it, "For whoever will save his life shall lose it, and whoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it." What of the law must we lose in order to save it? And what of Christianity must we lose to find it? To find it again, not according to the letter, but in spirit and truth. To be clear, I am not advocating here for the administrative unification of friends. Our diversity is a strength, and we should neither fear it nor bemoan it. It is essential, I think, that the diverse branches of friends remain true to their character and faithful to their respective callings. We can each play our roles within a larger drama without reducing the larger drama to our particular role within it. There are aspects of genuine Quaker work that liberals will always be better at doing than Orthodox friends, and aspects of genuine Quaker work that the Orthodox will excel at better than the liberals. What I do advocate, what I am suggesting, is that maybe we can each see ourselves and those of the other branches as living out a legitimate and faithful trajectory within Quakerism within the purview of a broader viewpoint, thus not as two solitudes or even as divergent branches, but as each tracing out a course within a shared field of force. Such would allow for mutual recognition even mutual appreciation, without insisting upon agreement, and without compromising our particular convictions and emphases. Such would allow Orthodox friends to appreciate and celebrate the freedom upon which the gospel opens and that liberal friends enjoy, as it would allow liberal friends to appreciate and respect the devoted embrace of that freedom-giving gospel practiced by the Orthodox, even if we continue to disagree about who has already gone too far and who has not yet gone far enough. Such would allow for an attenuation of the sometimes bitter, parochial, and polarizing debates over who are the real inheritors of Quakerism and who are the imposters. The point would not be to put an end to conversations over the essence of Quakerism, but to open them up. I am not suggesting we paper over our disagreements, that we do not have the debates we must have, but that we do so in a different spirit, in a radicalizing spirit that understands that innovation is both the fruit of groundedness and a perpetual challenge to it. And such would deepen the appreciation for and willingness to engage in, rather than what is currently almost universal suspicion from both sides, to engage in those painfully difficult but noble initiatives to bring friends of diverse orientations together for shared work and worship. Friends World Committee for Consultation, Friends United Meeting, Canadian Friends Service Committee, American Friends Service Committee, Friends Council for National Legislation, the Earlham School of Religion, United Society of Friends Women International, and others. Such would help us perhaps to overcome our dogmatism on both sides, and there is dogmatism on both sides, on all sides, and be teachable, that is, to be open to the leadership of the Spirit, or to be friends. That is perhaps only a crazy dream, but maybe crazy ones are the only dreams really worth dreaming.